job, and it's raining, you might have noticed.
The man in brown said pleasantly, Too damp for a good spray job, Art. Get moving.
I said, They're front and rear on the right side. You could use the spare for one spot if you're busy.
Take two jacks, Art,
the brown man said.
Now listen, Art began to bluster.
The brown man moved his eyes, looked at Art with a soft, quiet-eyed stare, lowered them again almost shyly. He didn't speak. Art rocked as if a gust of wind had hit him. He stamped over to the corner and put a rubber coat over his overalls, a sou'wester on his head. He grabbed a socket wrench and a hand jack and wheeled a dolly jack over to the doors. He went out silently, leaving the door yawning. The rain blustered in. The man in brown strolled over and shut it and strolled back to the workbench and put his hips exactly where they had been before. I could have taken him then. We were alone. He didn't know who I was. He looked at me lightly and threw his cigarette on the cement floor and stamped on it without looking down.
I bet you could use a drink, he said. Wet the inside and even up.
He reached a bottle from the workbench behind him and set it on the edge and set two glasses beside it. He poured a stiff jolt into each and held one out. Walking like a dummy, I went over and took it. The memory of the rain was still cold on my face. The smell of hot paint drugged the close air of the garage.
That Art, the brown man said. He's like all mechanics, always got his face in a job he ought to have done last week. Business trip?
I sniffed my drink delicately. It had the right smell. I watched him drink some of his before I swallowed mine. I rolled it around on my tongue. There was no cyanide in it. I emptied the little glass and put it down beside him and moved away. Partly, I said. I walked over to the half-painted sedan with the big metal paint gun lying along its fender. The rain hit the flat roof hard. Art was out in it, cursing. The brown man looked at the big car.
Just a panel job to start with,
he said casually, his purring voice still softer from the drink.
But the guy had dough and his driver needed a few bucks, you know the racket.
I said, There's only one that's older. My lips felt dry. I didn't want to talk. I lit a cigarette. I wanted my tires fixed. The minutes passed on tiptoe. The brown man and I were two strangers, chance met, looking at each other across a little dead man named Harry Jones. Only the brown man didn't know that yet. Feet crunched outside and the door was pushed open. The light hit pencils of rain and made silver wires of them. Art trundled two muddy flats in sullenly, kicked the door shut, let one of the flats fall over on its side. He looked at me savagely.
You sure pick spots for a jack to stand on, he snarled.
The brown man laughed and took a rolled cylinder of nickels out of his pocket and tossed it up and down on the palm of his hand.
Don't crab so much, he said dryly. Fix those flats.
I'm fixing them, ain't I?
Well, don't make a song about it.
Yeah.
Art peeled his rubber coat and sou'wester off and threw them away from him. He heaved one tire up on a spreader and tore the rim loose viciously. He had the tube out and cold patched in nothing flat. Still scowling, he strode over to the wall beside me and grabbed an air hose, put enough air into the tube to give it body, and let the nozzle of the raw air hose smack against the whitewashed wall. I stood watching the roll of wrapped coins dance in Canino's hand. The moment of crouched intensity had left me. I turned my head and watched the gaunt mechanic beside me toss the air-stiffened tube up and catch it with his hands wide, one on each side of the tube. He looked it over sourly, glanced at a big galvanized tub of dirty water in the corner and grunted. The teamwork must have been very nice. I saw no signal, no glance of meaning, no gesture that might have a special import. The gaunt man had the stiffened tube high in the air, staring at it. He half-turned his body, took one long, quick step, and slammed it down over my head and shoulders, a perfect ringer. He jumped behind me and leaned hard on the rubber. His weight dragged on my chest, pinned my upper arms tight to my sides. I could move my hands, but I couldn't reach the gun in my pocket. The brown man came almost dancing towards me across the floor. His hand tightened over the roll of nickels. He came up to me without sound, without expression. I bent forward and tried to heave Art off his feet. The fist with the weighted tube inside it went through my spread hands like a stone through a cloud of dust. I had the stunned moment of shock when the lights danced and the visible world went out of focus, but was still there. He hit me again. There was no sensation in my head. The bright glare got brighter. There was nothing but hard, aching white light. Then there was darkness, in which something red wriggled like a germ under a microscope. Then there was nothing bright or wriggling, just darkness and emptiness and a rushing wind and a falling as of great trees. 28. It seemed there was a woman, and she was sitting near a lamp, which was where she belonged, in a good light. Another light shone hard on my face, so I closed my eyes again and tried to look at her through the lashes. She was so platinumed that her hair shone like a silver fruit bowl. She wore a green knitted dress with a broad white collar turned over it. There was a sharp-angled glossy bag at her feet. She was smoking, and a glass of amber fluid was tall and pale at her elbow. I moved my head a little, carefully. It hurt, but not more than I expected. I was trussed like a turkey ready for the oven. Handcuffs held my wrists behind me, and a rope went from them to my ankles, and then over the end of the brown davenport on which I was sprawled. The rope dropped out of sight over the davenport. I moved enough to make sure it was tied down. I stopped these furtive movements and opened my eyes again and said, "Hello?" The woman withdrew her gaze from some distant mountain peak. Her small firm chin turned slowly. Her eyes were the blue of mountain lakes. Overhead, the rain still pounded, with a remote sound, as if it was somebody else's rain.
"How do you feel?"
It was a smooth, silvery voice that matched her hair. It had a tiny tinkle in it, like bells in a doll's house. I thought that was silly as soon as I thought of it. "Great," I said. "Somebody built a filling station on my jaw."
"What did you expect, Mr. Marlowe? Orchids?"
"Just a plain pine box," I said. "Don't bother with bronze or silver handles, and don't scatter my ashes over the blue Pacific. I like the worms better. Did you know that worms are of both sexes and that any worm can love any other worm?"
"You're a little light-headed,"
she said with a grave stare. "Would you mind moving this light?" She got up and went behind the davenport. The light went off. The dimness was a benison.
"I don't think you're so dangerous,"
she said. She was tall rather than short, but no beanpole. She was slim, but not a dried crust. She went back to her chair. "So you know my name?"
"You slept well. They had plenty of time to go through your pockets. They did everything but embalm you. So, you're a detective."
"Is that all they have on me?" She was silent. Smoke floated dimly from the cigarette. She moved it in the air. Her hand was small and had shape, not the usual bony garden tool you see on women nowadays. "What time is it?" I asked. She looked sideways at her wrist, beyond the spiral of smoke, at the edge of the grave luster of the lamplight.
10:17. You have a date?"
"I wouldn't be surprised. Is this the house next to Art Huck's garage?"
"Yes."
"What are the boys doing, digging a grave?"
"They had to go somewhere."
"You mean they left you here alone?" Her head turned slowly again. She smiled.
"You don't look dangerous."
"I thought they were keeping you a prisoner." It didn't seem to startle her. It even slightly amused her.
"What made you think that?"
"I know who you are." Her very blue eyes flashed so sharply that I could almost see the sweep of their glance, like the sweep of a sword. Her mouth tightened, but her voice didn't change.
"Then I'm afraid you're in a bad spot, and I hate killing."
"And you, Eddie Mars's wife? Shame on you." She didn't like that. She glared at me. I grinned. "Unless you can unlock these bracelets, which I'd advise you not to do, you might spare me a little of that drink you're neglecting." She brought the glass over. Bubbles rose in it like false hopes. She bent over me. Her breath was as delicate as the eyes of a fawn. I gulped from the glass. She took it away from my mouth and watched some of the liquid run down my neck. She bent over me again. Blood began to move around in me, like a prospective tenant looking over a house.
"Your face looks like a collision, Matt,"
she said. "Make the most of it. It won't last long, even this good." She swung her head sharply and listened. For an instant, her face was pale. The sounds were only the rain, drifting against the walls. She went back across the room and stood with her side to me, bent forward a little, looking down at the floor.
"Why did you come here and stick your neck out?"
she asked quietly.
"Eddie wasn't doing you any harm. You know perfectly well that if I hadn't hid out here, the police would have been certain Eddie murdered Rusty Regan."
"He did," I said. She didn't move, didn't change position an inch. Her breath made a harsh, quick sound. I looked around the room. Two doors, both in the same wall, one half open, a carpet of red and tan squares, blue curtains at the windows, a wallpaper with bright green pine trees on it. The furniture looked as if it had come from one of those places that advertise on bus benches, gay but full of resistance. She said softly,
"Eddie didn't do anything to him. I haven't seen Rusty in months. Eddie's not that sort of man."
"You left his bed and board. You were living alone. People at the place where you lived identified Regan's photo."
"That's a lie,"
she said coldly. I tried to remember whether Captain Gregory had said that or not. My head was too fuzzy. I couldn't be sure.
"And it's none of your business,"
she added. "The whole thing is my business. I'm hired to find out."
"Eddie's not that sort of man."
"Oh, you like racketeers."
"As long as people will gamble, there will be places for them to gamble."
"That's just protective thinking. Once outside the law, you're all the way outside. You think he's just a gambler? I think he's a pornographer, a blackmailer, a hot car broker, a killer by remote control, and a suborner of crooked cops. He's whatever looks good to him, whatever has the cabbage pinned to it. Don't try to sell me on any high-souled racketeers. They don't come in that pattern."
"He's not a killer,"
she frowned. "Not personally. He has Canino. Canino killed a man tonight. A harmless little guy who was trying to help somebody out. I almost saw him killed." She laughed wearily. "All right," I growled. "Don't believe it. If Eddie is such a nice guy, I'd like to get to talk to him without Canino around. You know what Canino will do, beat my teeth out and then kick me in the stomach for mumbling." She put her head back and stood there, thoughtful and withdrawn, thinking something out. "I thought platinum hair was out of style," I went on, just to keep sound alive in the room, just to keep from listening.
"It's a wig, silly, while mine grows out."
She reached up and yanked it off. Her own hair was clipped short all over like a boy's. She put the wig back on. "Who did that to you?" She looked surprised.
"I had it done. Why?"
"Yes, why?"
"Why, to show Eddie I was willing to do what he wanted me to do, hide out, that he didn't need to have me guarded. I wouldn't let him down. I love him."
"Good grief," I groaned. "And you have me right here in the room with you." She turned a hand over and stared at it. Then abruptly she walked out of the room. She came back with a kitchen knife. She bent and sought at my rope.
"Canino has the key to the handcuffs," she said. "I can't do anything about those."
She stepped back, breathing rapidly. She had cut the rope at every knot.
"You're a kick,"
she said.
"Kidding with every breath. The spot you're in."
"I thought Eddie wasn't a killer." She turned away quickly and went back to her chair by the lamp and sat down and put her face in her hands. I swung my feet to the floor and stood up. I tottered around, stiff-legged. The nerve on the left side of my face was jumping in all its branches. I took a step. I could still walk. I could run if I had to. "I guess you mean me to go," I said. She nodded without lifting her head. "You'd better go with me, if you want to keep on living."
"Don't waste time. He'll be back any minute."
"Light a cigarette for me." I stood beside her, touching her knees. She came to her feet with a sudden lurch. Our eyes were only inches apart. "Hello, Silverwig," I said softly. She stepped back around the chair and swept a package of cigarettes up off the table. She jabbed one loose and pushed it roughly into my mouth. Her hand was shaking. She snapped a small green leather lighter and held it to the cigarette. I drew in the smoke, staring into her lake blue eyes. While she was still close to me, I said, "A little bird named Harry Jones led me to you. A little bird that used to hop in and out of cocktail bars, picking up horse bets for crumbs, picking up information, too. This little bird picked up an idea about Canino. One way and another, he and his friends found out where you were. He came to me to sell the information because he knew. How he knew is a long story, that I was working for General Sternwood. I got his information, but Canino got the little bird. He's a dead little bird now, with his feathers ruffled and his neck limp and a pearl of blood on his beak. Canino killed him, but Eddie Mars wouldn't do that, would he? Silverwig? He never killed anybody, he just hires it done."
"Get out," she said harshly. "Get out of here quick."
Her hand clutched in midair on the green lighter. The fingers strained. The knuckles were as white as snow. "But Canino doesn't know I know that," I said, "about the little bird. All he knows is I'm nosing around." Then she laughed. It was almost a racking laugh. It shook her as the wind shakes a tree. I thought there was puzzlement in it. Not exactly surprise, but as if a new idea had been added to something already known, and it didn't fit. Then I thought that that was too much to get out of a laugh.
"It's very funny," she said breathlessly. "Very funny because, you see, I still love him. Women..."
She began to laugh again. I listened hard, my head throbbing. "Let's go," I said. "Fast." She took two steps back and her face set hard.
"Get out, you! Get out! You can walk to Rialito, you can make it, and you can keep your mouth shut for an hour or two at least. You owe me that much."
"Let's go," I said. "Got a gun, Silverwig?"
"You know I'm not going. You know that. Please, please get out of here quickly."
I stepped up close to her, almost pressing against her. "You're going to stay here after turning me loose? Wait for that killer to come back so you can say so sorry? A man who kills like swatting a fly? Not much. You're going with me, Silverwig."
"No."
"Suppose," I said, "your handsome husband did kill Regan. Or suppose Canino did without Eddie's knowing it. Just suppose. How long will you last after turning me loose?"
"I'm not afraid of Canino. I'm still his boss's wife."
"Eddie's a handful of mush," I snarled. "Canino would take him with a teaspoon. He'll take him the way the cat took the canary, a handful of mush. The only time a girl like you goes for a wrong G is when he's a handful of mush."
"Get out!"
She almost spat at me. "Okay." I turned away from her and moved out through the half-open door into a dark hallway. Then she rushed after me and pushed past the front door and opened it. She peered out into the wet blackness and listened. She motioned me forward.
"Goodbye,"
she said under her breath.
"Good luck in everything but one thing. Eddie didn't kill Rusty Regan. You'll find him alive and well somewhere when he wants to be found."
I leaned against her and pressed her against the wall with my body. I pushed my mouth against her face. I talked to her that way. "There's no hurry. All this was arranged in advance, rehearsed to the last detail, timed to the split second, just like a radio program. No hurry at all. Kiss me, Silverwig." Her face under my mouth was like ice. She put her hands up and took hold of my head and kissed me hard on the lips. Her lips were like ice, too. I went out through the door, and it closed behind me, without sound, and the rain blew in under the porch. Not as cold as her lips. 29. The garden next door was dark. I crossed the gravel drive and a patch of sodden lawn. The road ran with small rivulets of water. It gurgled down a ditch on the far side. I had no hat. That must have fallen in the garage. Canino hadn't bothered to give it back to me. He hadn't thought I would need it anymore. I imagined him driving back jauntily through the rain, alone, having left the gaunt and sulky Art and the probably stolen sedan in a safe place. She loved Eddie Mars, and she was hiding to protect him, so he would find her there when he came back, calm beside the light and the untasted drink and me tied up on the Davenport. He would carry her stuff out to the car and go through the house carefully to make sure nothing incriminating was left. He would tell her to go out and wait. She wouldn't hear a shot. A blackjack is just as effective at short range. He would tell her he had left me tied up and I would get loose after a while. He would think she was that dumb. Nice, Mr. Canino. The raincoat was open in front and I couldn't button it, being handcuffed. The skirts flapped against my legs like the wings of a large and tired bird. I came to the highway. Cars went by in a wide swirl of water illuminated by headlights. The tearing noise of their tires died swiftly. I found my convertible where I had left it, both tires fixed and mounted, so it could be driven away if necessary. They thought of everything. I got into it and leaned down sideways under the wheel and fumbled aside the flap of leather that covered the pocket. I got the other gun, stuffed it up under my coat, and started back. The world was small, shut in, black. A private world for Canino and me. Halfway there, the headlights nearly caught me. They turned swiftly off the highway, and I slid down the bank into the wet ditch and flopped there, breathing water. The car hummed by without slowing. I lifted my head, heard the rasp of its tires as it left the road and took the gravel of the driveway. The motor died. The lights died. A door slammed. I didn't hear the house door shut, but a fringe of light trickled through the clump of trees, as though a shade had been moved aside from a window, or the light had been put on in the hall. I came back to the soggy grass plot and sloshed across it. The car was between me and the house. The gun was down at my side, pulled as far around as I could get it without pulling my left arm out by the roots. The car was dark, empty, warm. Water gurgled pleasantly in the radiator. I peered in at the door. The keys hung on the dash. Canino was very sure of himself. I went around the car and walked carefully across the gravel to the window and listened. I couldn't hear any voices, any sound, but the swift bong-bong of the raindrops hitting the metal elbows at the bottom of the rain gutters. I kept on listening. No loud voices. Everything quiet and refined. He would be purring at her, and she would be telling him she had let me go, and I had promised to let them get away. He wouldn't believe me, as I wouldn't believe him, so he wouldn't be in there long. He would be on his way and take her with him. All I had to do was wait for him to come out. I couldn't do it. I shifted the gun to my left hand and leaned down to scoop up a handful of gravel. I tossed it against the screen of the window. It was a feeble effort. Very little of it reached the glass above the screen, but the loose rattle of that little was like a dam bursting. I ran back to the car and got on the running board behind it. The house had already gone dark. That was all. I dropped quietly on the running board and waited. No soap. Canino was too cagey. I straightened up and got into the car backwards, fumbled around for the ignition key and turned it. I reached with my foot, but the starter button had to be on the dash. I found it at last, pulled it, and the starter ground. The warm motor caught at once. It purred softly, contentedly. I got out of the car again and crouched down by the rear wheels. I was shivering now, but I knew Canino wouldn't like that last effect. He needed that car, badly. A darkened window slid down, inch by inch, only some shifting of light on the glass showing it moved. Flames spouted from it abruptly, the blended roar of three swift shots. Glass starred in the coupe. I yelled with agony. The yell went off into a wailing groan. The groan became a wet gurgle, choked with blood. I let the gurgle die, sickeningly, on a choked gasp. It was nice work. I liked it. Canino liked it very much. I heard him laugh. It was a large, booming laugh, not at all like the purr of his speaking voice. Then silence for a little while, except for the rain and the quietly throbbing motor of the car. Then the house door crawled open, a deeper blackness in the black night. A figure showed in it, cautiously, something white around the neck. It was her collar. She came out on the porch, stiffly, a wooden woman. I caught the pale shine of her silver wig. Canino came crouched methodically behind her. It was so deadly it was almost funny. She came down the steps. Now I could see the white stiffness of her face. She started towards the car, a bulwark of defense for Canino in case I could still spit in his eye. Her voice spoke through the lisp of the rain, saying slowly, without any tone,
"I can't see a thing, Lash. The windows are misted."
He grunted something, and the girl's body jerked hard, as though he had jammed a gun into her back. She came on again and drew near the lightless car. I could see him behind her now, his hat, a side of his face, the bulk of his shoulder. The girl stopped, rigid, and screamed, a beautiful, thin, tearing scream that rocked me like a left hook.
"I can see him," she screamed. "Through the window, behind the wheel, Lash!"
He fell for it like a bucket of lead. He knocked her roughly to one side and jumped forward, throwing his hand up. Three more spurts of flame cut the darkness, more glass scarred. One bullet went on through and smacked into a tree on my side. A ricochet whined off into the distance, but the motor went quietly on. He was low down, crouched against the gloom, his face a grayness without form that seemed to come back slowly after the glare of the shots. If it was a revolver he had, it might be empty. It might not. He had fired 6 times, but he might have reloaded inside the house. I hoped he had. I didn't want him with an empty gun. But it might be an automatic. I said, "Finished?" He whirled at me. Perhaps it would have been nice to allow him another shot or two, just like a gentleman of the old school, but his gun was still up and I couldn't wait any longer. Not long enough to be a gentleman of the old school. I shot him 4 times, the Colt straining against my ribs. The gun jumped out of his hand as if it had been kicked. He reached both his hands for his stomach. I could hear them smack hard against his body. He fell like that, straight forward, holding himself together with his broad hands. He fell face down in the wet gravel, and after that there wasn't a sound from him. Silver Wig didn't make a sound either. She stood rigid with the rain swirling at her. I walked around Canino and kicked his gun without any purpose. Then I walked after it and bent over sideways and picked it up. That put me close to her. She spoke moodily, as if she was talking to herself.
I was afraid you'd come back.
I said, "We had a date. I told you it was all arranged." I began to laugh like a loon. Then she was bending down over him, touching him, and after a little while she stood up with a small key on a thin chain. She said bitterly,
"Did you have to kill him?"
I stopped laughing as suddenly as I had started. She went behind me and unlocked the handcuffs.
"Yes,"
she said softly.
"I suppose you did."
30. This was another day and the sun was shining again. Captain Gregory of the Missing Persons Bureau looked heavily out of his office window at the barred upper floor of the Hall of Justice, white and clean after the rain. Then he turned ponderously in his swivel chair and tamped his pipe with a heat-scarred thumb and stared at me bleakly.
"So you got yourself in another jam. Oh, you heard about it. Brother, I sit here all day on my fanny and I don't look as if I had a brain in my head, but you'd be surprised what I hear. Shooting this Canino is all right, I guess, but I don't figure the homicide boys pinned any medals on you."
"There's been a lot of killings going on around me," I said. "I haven't been getting my share of it." He smiled patiently.
"Who told you this girl out there was Eddie Mars's wife?"
I told him. He listened carefully and yawned. He tapped his gold-studded mouth with a palm like a tray.
"I guess you figure I ought to have found her."
"That's a fair deduction."
"Maybe I knew,"
he said.
"Maybe I thought if Eddie and his woman wanted to play a little game like that, it would be smart, or as smart as I ever get, to let them think they were getting away with it. And then again, maybe you think I was letting Eddie get away with it for more personal reasons."
He held his big hand out and revolved the thumb against the index and second fingers. "No," I said, "I didn't really think that. Not even when Eddie seemed to know all about our talk here the other day." He raised his eyebrows as if raising them was an effort, a trick he was out of practice on. It furrowed his whole forehead, and when it smoothed out it was full of white lines that turned reddish as I watched them.
"I'm a copper," he said. Just a plain, ordinary copper. Reasonably honest as you could expect a man to be in a world where it's out of style. That's mainly why I asked you to come in this morning. I'd like you to believe that. Being a copper, I like to see the law win. I'd like to see the flashy, well-dressed mugs like Eddie Marr spoiling their manicures in the rock quarry at Folsom, alongside of the poor little slum-bred hard guys that got knocked over on their first caper and never had a break since. That's what I'd like. You and me both lived too long to think I'm likely to see it happen. Not in this town, not in any town half this size, in any part of this wide, green, and beautiful USA. We just don't run our country that way.
I didn't say anything. He blew smoke with a backward jerk of his head, looked at the mouthpiece of his pipe, and went on.
But that don't mean I think Eddie Marr's bumped off Regan or had any reason to or would have done it if he had. I just figured maybe he knows something about it, and maybe sooner or later something will sneak out into the open. Hiding his wife out at Rialito was childish, but it's the kind of childishness a smart monkey thinks is smart. I had him in here last night after the DA got through with him. He admitted the whole thing. He said he knew Canino as a reliable protection guy, and that's what he had him for. He didn't know anything about his hobbies or want to. He didn't know Harry Jones. He didn't know Joe Brody. He didn't know Geiger, of course, but claims he didn't know about his racket. I guess you heard all that?
Yes.
You played it smart down there at Rialito, brother. Not trying to cover up. We keep a file on unidentified bullets nowadays. Someday you might use that gun again. Then you'd be over a barrel.
I played it smart, I said, and leered at him. He knocked his pipe out and stared down at it broodingly.
What happened to the girl?
He asked, not looking up. I don't know. They didn't hold her. We made statements, three sets of them, for Wild, for the sheriff's office, for the homicide bureau. They turned her loose. I haven't seen her since. I don't expect to.
Kind of a nice girl, they say. Wouldn't be one to play dirty games.
Kind of a nice girl, I said. Captain Gregory sighed and rumpled his mousy hair.
There's just one more thing, he said almost gently. You look like a nice guy, but you play too rough. If you really want to help the Sternwood family, leave them alone.
I think you're right, Captain.
How you feel?
Swell, I said. I was standing on various pieces of carpet most of the night being bawled out. Before that, I got soaked to the skin and beaten up. I'm in perfect condition.
What the hell did you expect, brother?
Nothing else. I stood up and grinned at him and started for the door. When I had almost reached it, he cleared his throat suddenly and said in a harsh voice,
I'm wasting my breath, huh? You still think you can find Regan?
I turned round and looked him straight in the eyes. No. I don't think I can find Regan. I'm not even going to try. Does that suit you? He nodded slowly. Then he shrugged.
I don't know what the hell I even said that for. Good luck, Marlowe. Drop around any time.
Thanks, Captain. I went down out of the city hall and got my car from the parking lot and drove home to the Hobart Arms. I lay down on the bed with my coat off and stared at the ceiling and listened to the traffic sounds on the street outside and watched the sun move slowly across a corner of the ceiling. I tried to go to sleep, but sleep didn't come. I got up and took a drink, although it was the wrong time of day, and lay down again. I still couldn't go to sleep. My brain ticked like a clock. I sat up on the side of the bed and stuffed the pipe and said out loud, "That old buzzard knows something." The pipe tasted as bitter as lye. I put it aside and lay down again. My mind drifted through waves of false memory in which I seemed to do the same thing over and over again, go to the same places, meet the same people, say the same words to them over and over again, and yet each time it seemed real, like something actually happening, and for the first time. I was driving hard along the highway through the rain with Silver Wig in the corner of the car saying nothing so that by the time we reached Los Angeles, we seemed to be utter strangers again. I was getting out at an all-night drugstore and phoning Bernie Oles that I had killed a man at Rialito, and I was on my way over to Wilde's house with Eddie Mars' wife, who had seen me do it. I was pushing the car along the silent, rain-polished streets of Lafayette Park and up under the porte-cochere of Wilde's big frame house, and the porch light was already on, Oles having telephoned ahead that I was coming. I was in Wilde's study, and he was behind his desk in a flowered dressing gown and a tight, hard face, and a dappled cigar moved in his fingers and up to the bitter smile on his lips. Oles was there, and a slim, gray, scholarly man from the sheriff's office who looked and talked more like a professor of economics than a cop. I was telling the story, and they were listening quietly, and Silverwig sat in a shadow with her hands folded in her lap, looking at nobody. There was a lot of telephoning. There were two men from the Homicide Bureau who looked at me as if I was some kind of strange beast escaped from a traveling circus. I was driving again with one of them beside me to the Fulwider building. We were there in the room where Harry Jones was still in the chair behind the desk, the twisted stiffness of his dead face and the sour-sweet smell in the room. There was a medical examiner, very young and husky, with red bristles on his neck. There was a fingerprint man fussing around, and I was telling him not to forget the latch of the transom. He found Canino's thumbprint on it, the only print the brown man had left to back up my story. I was back again at Wilde's house, signing a typewritten statement his secretary had run off in another room. Then the door opened, and Eddie Mars came in, and an abrupt smile flashed to his face when he saw Silverwig, and he said, "Hello, sugar," and she didn't look at him or answer him. Eddie Mars, fresh and cheerful in a dark business suit, with a fringed white scarf hanging outside his tweed overcoat. Then they were gone. Everybody was gone, out of the room, but myself and Wilde, and Wilde was saying in a cold, angry voice, "This is the last time, Marlowe. The next fast one you pull, I'll throw you to the lions, no matter whose heart it breaks." It was like that over and over again, lying on the bed, and watching the patch of sunlight slide down the corner of the wall. Then the phone rang, and it was Norris, the Sternwood butler, with his usual untouchable voice.
"Mr. Marlowe, I telephoned your office without success, so I took the liberty of trying to reach you at home."
"I was out most of the night," I said. "I haven't been down."
"Yes, sir. The General would like to see you this morning, Mr. Marlowe, if it's convenient."
"Half an hour or so," I said. "How is he?"
"He's in bed, sir, but not doing badly."
"Wait till he sees me," I said, and hung up. I shaved, changed clothes, and started for the door. Then I went back and got Carmen's little pearl-handled revolver and dropped it into my pocket. The sunlight was so bright that it danced. I got to the Sternwood place in 20 minutes and drove up under the arch at the side door. It was 11:15. The birds in the ornamental trees were crazy with song after the rain. The terraced lawns were as green as the Irish flag, and the whole estate looked as though it had been made about 10 minutes before. I rang the bell. It was 5 days since I had rung it for the first time. It felt like a year. A maid opened the door and led me along a side hall to the main hallway and left me there, saying Mr. Norris would be down in a moment. The main hallway looked just the same. The portrait over the mantel had the same hot black eyes, and the knight in the stained glass window still wasn't getting anywhere untying the naked damsel from the tree. In a few minutes Norris appeared, and he hadn't changed either. His acid blue eyes were as remote as ever, his grayish pink skin looked healthy and rested, and he moved as if he was 20 years younger than he really was. I was the one who felt the weight of the years. We went up the tiled staircase and turned the opposite way from Vivian's room. With each step, the house seemed to grow larger and more silent. We reached a massive old door that looked as if it had come out of a church. Norris opened it softly and looked in. Then he stood aside, and I went in past him across what seemed to be about a quarter of a mile of carpet to a huge canopied bed, like the one Henry VIII died in. General Sternwood was propped up on pillows. His bloodless hands were clasped on top of the sheet. They looked gray against it. His black eyes were still full of fight, and the rest of his face still looked like the face of a corpse.
"Sit down, Mr. Marlowe,"
His voice sounded weary and a little stiff. I pulled a chair close to him and sat down. All the windows were shut tight. The room was sunless at that hour. Awnings cut off what glare there might be from the sky. The air had the faint Swedish smell of old age. He stared at me silently for a long minute. He moved a hand as if to prove to himself that he could still move it, then folded it back over the other. He said, lifelessly,
"I didn't ask you to look for my son-in-law, Mr. Marlowe."
"You wanted me to, though."
"I didn't ask you to. You assume a great deal. I usually ask for what I want."
I didn't say anything.
"You have been paid," he went on coldly. "The money is of no consequence one way or the other. I merely feel that you have, no doubt unintentionally, betrayed a trust."
He closed his eyes on that. I said, "Is that all you wanted to see me about?" He opened his eyes again very slowly, as though the lids were made of lead.
"I suppose you are angry at that remark,"
he said. I shook my head. "You have an advantage over me, General. It's an advantage I wouldn't want to take away from you, not a hair of it. It's not much, considering what you have to put up with. You can say anything you like to me, and I wouldn't think of getting angry. I'd like to offer you your money back. It may mean nothing to you. It might mean something to me."
"What does it mean to you?"
"It means I have refused payment for an unsatisfactory job. That's all."
"Do you do many unsatisfactory jobs?"
"A few. Everyone does."
"Why did you go to see Captain Gregory?"
I leaned back and hung an arm over the back of the chair. I studied his face. It told me nothing. I didn't know the answer to his question. No satisfactory answer. I said, "I was convinced you put those Geiger notes up to me chiefly as a test, and that you were a little afraid Regan might somehow be involved in an attempt to blackmail you. I didn't know anything about Regan then. It wasn't until I talked to Captain Gregory that I realized Regan wasn't that sort of guy, in all probability."
"That is scarcely answering my question."
I nodded. "No, that is scarcely answering your question. I guess I just don't like to admit that I played a hunch. The morning I was here, after I left you out in the Orchid House, Mrs. Regan sent for me. She seemed to assume I was hired to look for her husband, and she didn't seem to like it. She let drop, however, that they had found his car in a certain garage. The they could only be the police. Consequently, the police must know something about it. If they did, the Missing Persons Bureau would be the department that would have the case. I didn't know whether you had reported it, of course, or somebody else, or whether they had found the car through somebody reporting it, abandoned in a garage. But I know cops, and I knew that if they got that much, they would get a little more, especially as your driver happened to have a police record. I didn't know how much more they would get. That started me thinking about the Missing Persons Bureau. What convinced me was something in Mr. Wilde's manner the night we had the confidence over at his house about Geiger and so on. We were alone for a minute, and he asked me whether you had told me you were looking for Regan. I said you had told me you wished you knew where he was, and that he was all right. Wilde pulled his lip in and looked funny. I knew just as plainly as though he had said it that by looking for Regan, he meant using the machinery of the law to look for him. Even then, I tried to go up against Captain Gregory in such a way that I wouldn't tell him anything he didn't know already."
"And you allowed Captain Gregory to think I had employed you to find Rusty?"
"Yeah, I guess I did, when I was sure he had the case." He closed his eyes. They twitched a little. He spoke with them closed.
"And do you consider that ethical?"
"Yes," I said, "I do." The eyes opened again. The piercing blackness of them was startling, coming suddenly out of that dead face.
"Perhaps I don't understand," he said.
"Maybe you don't. The head of a missing persons bureau isn't a talker. He wouldn't be in that office if he was. This one is a very smart, cagey guy who tries, with a lot of success at first, to give the impression he's a middle-aged hack fed up with his job. The game I play is not Spillikins. There's always a large element of bluff connected with it. Whatever I might say to a cop, he would be apt to discount it, and to that cop, it wouldn't make much difference what I said. When you hire a boy in my line of work, it isn't like hiring a window washer and showing him 8 windows and saying, wash those and you're through. You don't know what I have to go through or over or under to do your job for you. I do it my way. I do my best to protect you, and I may break a few rules, but I break them in your favor. The client comes first, unless he's crooked. Even then, all I do is hand the job back to him and keep my mouth shut. After all, you didn't tell me not to go to Captain Gregory.
That would have been rather difficult,
he said with a faint smile. Well, what have I done wrong? Your man Norris seemed to think when Geiger was eliminated the case was over. I don't see it that way. Geiger's method of approach puzzled me and still does. I'm not Sherlock Holmes or Philo Vance. I don't expect to go over ground the police have covered and pick up a broken pinpoint and build a case from it. If you think there is anybody in the detective business making a living doing that sort of thing, you don't know much about cops. It's not things like that they overlook if they overlook anything. I'm not saying they often overlook anything when they're really allowed to work, but if they do, it's apt to be something looser and vaguer. Like a man of Geiger's type sending you his evidence of debt and asking you to pay like a gentleman. Geiger, a man in a shady racket, in a vulnerable position, protected by a racketeer and having at least some negative protection from some of the police. Why did he do that? Because he wanted to find out if there was anything putting pressure on you. If there was, you would pay him. If not, you would ignore him and wait for his next move. But there was something putting a pressure on you. Regan, you were afraid he was not what he had appeared to be, that he had stayed around and had been nice to you just long enough to find out how to play games with your bank account. He started to say something, but I interrupted him. Even at that, it wasn't your money you cared about. It wasn't even your daughters. You've more or less written them off. It's that you're still too proud to be played for a sucker. And you really liked Regan. There was a silence. Then the general said quietly,
"You talk too damn much, Marlowe. Am I to understand you are still trying to solve that puzzle?"
"No, I've quit. I've been warned off. The boys think I play too rough. That's why I thought I should give you back your money, because it isn't a complicated job by my standards." He smiled.
"Quit nothing,"
he said.
"I'll pay you another $1,000 to find Rusty. He doesn't have to come back. I don't even have to know where he is. A man has a right to live his own life. I don't blame him for walking out on my daughter, nor even for going so abruptly. It was probably a sudden impulse. I want to know that he is all right, wherever he is. I want to know it from him directly, and if he should happen to need money, I should want him to have that also. Am I clear?"
I said, "Yes, General." He rested a little while, lax on the bed, his eyes closed and dark-lidded, his mouth tight and bloodless. He was used up. He was pretty nearly licked. He opened his eyes again and tried to grin at me.
"I guess I'm a sentimental old goat,"
he said,
"and no soldier at all. I took a fancy to that boy. He seemed pretty clean to me. I must be a little too vain about my judgment of character. Find him for me, Marlowe. Just find him."
"I'll try," I said. "You'd better rest now. I've talked your arm off." I got up quickly and walked across the wide floor and out. He had his eyes shut again before I opened the door. His hands lay limp on the sheet. He looked a lot more like a dead man than most dead men look. I shut the door quietly and went back along the upper hall and down the stairs. 31. The butler appeared with my hat. I put it on and said, "What do you think of him?"
"He's not as weak as he looks, sir."
"If he was, he'd be ready for burial. What did this Regan fellow have that bored into him so?" The butler looked at me levelly and yet with a queer lack of expression.
"Youth, sir,"
he said,
and the soldier's eye.
Like yours, I said.
If I may say so, sir, not unlike yours.
Thanks. How are the ladies this morning? He shrugged politely. Just what I thought, I said, and he opened the door for me. I stood outside on the step and looked down the vistas of grassed terraces and trimmed trees and flower beds to the tall metal railing at the bottom of the gardens. I saw Carmen about halfway down, sitting on a stone bench with her head between her hands, looking forlorn and alone. I went down the red brick steps that led from terrace to terrace. I was quite close before she heard me. She jumped up and whirled like a cat. She wore the light blue slacks she had worn the first time I saw her. Her blonde hair was the same loose, tawny wave. Her face was white. Red spots flared in her cheeks as she looked at me. Her eyes were slaty. "Bored?" I said. She smiled slowly, rather shyly, then nodded quickly. Then she whispered,
"You're not mad at me?"
"I thought you were mad at me." She put her thumb up and giggled.
"I'm not."
When she giggled, I didn't like her anymore. I looked around. A target hung on a tree about 30 feet away with some darts sticking to it. There were three or four more on the stone bench where she had been sitting. "For people with money, you and your sister don't seem to have much fun," I said. She looked at me under her long lashes. This was the look that was supposed to make me roll over on my back. I said, "You like throwing those darts?"
"Uh-huh."
"That reminds me of something." I looked back towards the house. By moving about 3 feet, I made a tree hide me from it. I took her little pearl-handled gun out of my pocket. "I brought you back your artillery. I cleaned it and loaded it up. Take my tip. Don't shoot it at people unless you get to be a better shot. Remember?" Her face went paler and her thin thumb dropped. She looked at me, then at the gun I was holding. There was a fascination in her eyes.
"Yes,"
she said and nodded. Then suddenly,
"Teach me to shoot."
"Huh?"
"Teach me how to shoot. I'd like that."
"Here? It's against the law." She came close to me and took the gun out of my hand, cuddled her hand around the butt. Then she tucked it quickly inside her slacks, almost with a furtive movement, and looked around.
"I know where,"
she said in a secret voice.
"Down by some of the old wells."
She pointed off down the hill.
"Teach me."
I looked into her slaty blue eyes. I might as well have looked at a couple of bottle tops. "All right. Give me back the gun until I see if the place looks all right." She smiled and made a mouth, then handed it back with a secret, naughty air as if she was giving me a key to her room. We walked up the steps and around to my car. The gardens seemed deserted. The sunshine was as empty as a headwaiter's smile. We got into the car and I drove down the sunken driveway and out through the gates. "Where's Vivian?" I asked.
"Not up yet,"
she giggled. I drove on down the hill through the quiet, opulent streets with their faces washed by the rain, bore east to La Brea, then south. We reached the place she meant in about 10 minutes.
"In there,"
she leaned out of the window and pointed. It was a narrow dirt road, not much more than a track, like the entrance to some foothill ranch. A wide, five-barred gate was folded back against a stump and looked as if it hadn't been shut in years. The road was fringed with tall eucalyptus trees and deeply rutted. Trucks had used it. It was empty and sunny now, but not yet dusty. The rain had been too hard and too recent. I followed the ruts along, and the noise of city traffic grew curiously and quickly faint, as if this were not in the city at all, but far away in a daydream land. Then the oil-stained, motionless walking beam of a squat wooden derrick stuck up over a branch. I could see the rusty old steel cable that connected this walking beam with half a dozen others. The beams didn't move, probably hadn't moved for a year. The wells were no longer pumping. There was a pile of rusted pipe, a loading platform that sagged at one end, half a dozen empty oil drums lying in a ragged pile. There was the stagnant, oil-scummed water of an old sump, iridescent in the sunlight. "Are they going to make a park of all this?" I asked. She dipped her chin down and gleamed at me. "It's about time. The smell of that sump would poison a herd of goats. This is the place you had in mind?
Uh-huh. Like it?
It's beautiful. I pulled up beside the loading platform. We got out. I listened. The hum of the traffic was a distant web of sound, like the buzzing of trees. The place was as lonely as a churchyard. Even after the rain, the tall eucalyptus trees still looked dusty. They always looked dusty. A branch broken off by the wind had fallen over the edge of the sump, and the flat, leathery leaves dangled in the water. I walked around the sump and looked into the pump house. There was some junk in it, nothing that looked like recent activity. Outside, a big wooden bull wheel was tilted against the wall. It looked like a good place, all right. I went back to the car. The girl stood beside it, preening her hair and holding it out in the sun.
"Gimme,"
she said, and held her hand out. I took the gun out and put it in her palm. I bent down and picked up a rusty can. "Take it easy now," I said. "It's loaded in all five. I'll go over and set this can in that square opening in the middle of that big wooden wheel. See?" I pointed. She ducked her head, delighted. "It's about 30 feet. Don't start shooting until I get back beside you, okay?"
"Okay,"
she giggled. I went back around the sump and set the can up in the middle of the bull wheel. It made a swell target. If she missed the can, which she was certain to do, she would probably hit the wheel. That would stop a small slug completely. However, she wasn't going to hit even that. I went back towards her around the sump. When I was about 10 feet from her at the edge of the sump, she showed me all her sharp little teeth and brought the gun up and started to hiss. I stopped dead, the sump water stagnant and stinking at my back.
"Stand there, you son of a bitch,"
she said. The gun pointed at my chest. Her hand seemed to be quite steady. The hissing sound grew louder, and her face had the scraped bone look. Aged, deteriorated, become animal, and not a nice animal. I laughed at her. I started to walk towards her. I saw her small finger tighten on the trigger and grow white at the tip. I was about 6 feet away from her when she started to shoot. The sound of the gun made a sharp slap, without body, a brittle crack in the sunlight. I didn't see any smoke. I stopped again and grinned at her. She fired twice more, very quickly. I don't think any of the shots would have missed. There were five in the little gun. She had fired four. I rushed her. I didn't want the last one in my face, so I swerved to one side. She gave it to me quite carefully, not worried at all. I think I felt the hot breath of the powder blast a little. I straightened up. "My, but you're cute," I said. Her hand holding the empty gun began to shake violently. The gun fell out of it. Her mouth began to shake. Her whole face went to pieces. Then her head screwed up towards her left ear and froth showed on her lips. Her breath made a whining sound. She swayed. I caught her as she fell. She was already unconscious. I prized her teeth open with both hands and stuffed a wadded handkerchief in between them. It took all my strength to do it. I lifted her up and got her into the car, then went back for the gun and dropped it into my pocket. I climbed in under the wheel, backed the car, and drove back the way we had come along the rutted road, out of the gateway, back up the hill and so home. Carmen lay crumpled in the corner of the car without motion. I was halfway up the drive to the house before she stirred. Then her eyes suddenly opened wide and wild. She sat up.
"What happened?"
she gasped. "Nothing. Why?"
"Oh, yes, it did,"
she giggled.
"I wet myself."
"They always do," I said. She looked at me with a sudden sick speculation and began to moan. 32. The gentle-eyed, horse-faced maid let me into the long gray and white upstairs sitting room with the ivory drapes tumbled extravagantly on the floor and the white carpet from wall to wall. A screen star's boudoir, a place of charm and seduction, artificial as a wooden leg. It was empty at the moment. The door closed behind me with the unnatural softness of a hospital door. A breakfast table on wheels stood by the chaise longue. Its silver glittered. There were cigarette ashes in the coffee cup. I sat down and waited. It seemed a long time before the door opened again and Vivian came in. She was in oyster-white lounging pajamas trimmed with white fur, cut as flowingly as a summer sea frothing on the beach of some small and exclusive island. She went past me in long, smooth strides and sat down on the edge of the chaise longue. There was a cigarette in her lips at the corner of her mouth. Her nails today were copper red from quick to tip, without half moons.
So you're just